Hello and welcome to Pod Catalyst. I'm Peter Finn, Executive Director at IABC, or the International Association of Business Communicators. And for this episode, I spoke with Cam Nafisi. He is a communication strategist and consultant with over 20 years experience who writes regularly about finance, communications, and ESG. He's the founder and principal of Connect Comms, a strategic communications consultancy to companies, entrepreneurs, and investors in the financial services and fintech sectors. Prior to moving into consultancy, he worked in-house in communication roles at JP Morgan, London Stock Exchange Group, UniCredit, and BP. Earlier in his career, he was a business analyst and management consultant, consulting and a financial analyst in investment banking. Cam also serves on IBC's International Executive Board and is co-lead of the Marketing Special Interest Group at Cambridge University Judge Business School. He's also a member of the Forbes Agency Council. Cam has worked in a number of global businesses and financial centers, including London, New York, Los Angeles, Paris, and Milan. He is a graduate of the London School of Economics and Cambridge University. And I really enjoyed my conversation with Cam, just getting to know a little bit more about his background and just the work that he's done in ESG is extraordinary, but just a wealth of knowledge. So I think you'll really enjoy the interview.
Cam, thanks so much for joining us for Pod Catalyst. We usually do is just ask every guest to just give a quick intro about yourself, your background. For those, I know Cam is on our international executive board, but Cam, just a little bit about yourself, you know, your background, how you got to where you are.
Yeah, sure. Hi, Peter. Thanks so much for having me on the show. It's great to be here. So I'm a communication strategist and consultant. I have about 20 years experience in the industry. I'm the founder of a strategic communications consultancy called Connect Comms. And we specialize in financial services and fintech. And I moved into consultancy a few years ago after having worked a number of years in-house. So I worked at a number of large financial institutions around the world. I was at JP Morgan, London Stock Exchange Group, UniCredit. And before that, I worked briefly early in my career in management consulting and investment banking. And as I mentioned, I've been lucky enough to live in many different sort of business hubs. And I'm based in London now, but I've worked in London, New York, LA, Paris, Milan. So I have a very much a global mindset and perspective on things.
Well, I know, you know, because you know, some of what we're going to talk about today is ESG. And what was kind of your first introduction to that topic? Because I know that's something that you focus on in the work that you do in your practice.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think in my kind of professional experience, it's kind of always been there in some ways, in one shape or form or another. And it's a hard thing to get your head around. Because even though I've been doing one kind of ESG or other for the best part of the last 20 years, I kind of had a quick Google of it nonetheless, you know, to see what's out there. And it's actually very difficult to define. I had sort of 436 million results come back on Google, which incidentally is 100 million more than Kim Kardashian. So it's one of these things where if you ask 10 people, you get 10 different answers. Yeah. But I would say really, I really became aware of it probably about 20 years ago, around 2004, when the UN put out a big report advocating for increased integration of ESG factors into investment processes. And I think ever since then, it's kind of gained traction.
And so what's, you know, when someone, you know, it's like, what's ESG, Cam? What's your short answer typically? Or just, you know, practically speaking, you know, what are some of the things that you convey to others?
Yeah, I mean, you know, for me, ESG, so environmental, social, and corporate governance is a framework for, you know, how you consider sustainability-related risks and opportunities that are to do with all stakeholders, not just shareholders. How do you consider those? And how do you bring those into the heart of how a company is valued and managed? So how do you make it intrinsic to business and investing activity? And that way of thinking about it, I think, bridges what investors mean by it and what companies mean by it, because there is a bit of a disconnect in the language of ESG between those groups.
And, you know, for a communication professional, like what is that? What is the role that communications professionals play in this? And because certainly you're in the middle of this and just curious, because I've also, you know, I've talked obviously IBC members and, you know, there's just a lot of different perspectives, but I'd love to hear, you know, kind of what you think this means for communication professionals.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. And for me, I think at the heart of it, it's really about, you know, what do you do and say about ESG? And then when you figure that out, you know, how do you do it and say it well? And I think comms people kind of really much sit at the heart of that. So even though there's no one-size-fits-all solution for comms professionals tackling ESG, there is a process around it about how you can approach it, which I think is different if you're working for a company versus an investor, by which I mean an asset manager or an asset owner. But there are broadly some similar principles that apply, you know, which I can kind of dive into
I mean, do you think that there's an emerging playbook that's, you know, that's kind of for communication professionals? You know, when you think about kind of the polarization on, you know, issues like climate change, are there some guiding principles for communication professionals?
Yeah, you know what, I think, you know, in terms of a playbook or guiding principles, you know, I think there are a number of principles that, as you know, we as communications professionals can put into practice. And as I said, it's a bit different if you work for a company versus a sort of investment manager. But some of the principles are broadly the same. So I think there's a number of steps. So in my mind, the first step is management teams need to do a purpose discovery exercise and also a materiality assessment. And then comms teams, you know, play a really important role in both those processes, you know, especially the purpose exercise. And, you know, one tangible way to approach purpose, which I talked about in recent IABC Trendwatch, you know, report, is kind of thinking about four dimensions. So, you know, you've got all the risks that your business faces, you've got all the risks or all the issues that society faces or your community faces. So those are two kind of dimensions. And then you've got the growth opportunities for your business and the kind of hopes and wants of society. So those are four dimensions. And if you think of those visually, almost like four circles in a Venn diagram, the intersection of those four circles is where you should be identifying and articulating your corporate purpose. That's where you derive your purpose statement. And I would say that the materiality assessment that should be done either at the same time or just afterwards, that's about identifying the specific aspects of ESG that are most important to your stakeholders. And just one other thing to add there is the key thing for me, and Peter, you talked about political polarization, for example, the key thing for me is that you really do need to understand what your stakeholders want from ESG, you know, especially customers and employees. And, you know, we have very sophisticated mechanisms for figuring out what shareholders want from a company. You know, we've got equity markets and the investment process and proxy voting, but we have to have a really effective process for understanding what do non-shareholders, what do customers and employees want. And as comms people, we have all those tools, you know, whether it's market research, employee research, whether it's social media listening, monitoring. So we have to make sure we bring those voices into the center of this purpose development exercise, you know, to have that kind of legitimacy and mandate.
Yeah, and kind of go back to, you know, saying like when you first kind of heard about it, ESG and, you know, the concept, and when do you think it really kind of gained traction with organizations? I mean, is this something you've seen just within the last 5 to 10 years, or has really picked up steam in the last 2 years? I mean, what do you see in terms of the timeline? And then, you know, I guess on top of that, like, where do you see it going? I mean, do you think it will continue to have the momentum that it's had over the last few years?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting to kind of see the evolution. I mean, I think, as I mentioned briefly earlier, you know, in my mind, it kind of started around 2004 with the UN report I mentioned, which was really calling for greater inclusion of ESG in investment decisions. And then, you know, if you look at some really interesting research I came across by PIMCO, the asset manager, they found that from roughly that time, actually from 2005 to 2018, ESG was mentioned in fewer than 1% of earnings calls. And then by 2021, so just a year ago, it was mentioned in almost a fifth of all earnings calls. So, I mean, that's the investment part of the story, which is where it all started. But there's also been other milestones, of course, along the way. There was a notable business roundtable statement in 2019, you know, with a group of leading US executives and business leaders, including, you know, likes of Larry Fink at BlackRock, who kind of committed their businesses to the principles of stakeholder capitalism. And then now, literally, I think just in the last year or so, there's been a lot of sort of backlash against the concept of ESG. So you have views about it that are polarizing along political lines. You know, you've got US Republican lawmakers pushing back on it. You know, even this year, you had sort of Elon Musk call ESG a devil incarnate. So it's had a really colorful history in its journey to the mainstream. And in terms of sort of where it's going, Peter, I mean, you're asking what kind of lies ahead. I think it's really useful to think about it in terms of the mega trends that are driving ESG and where it's coming from. You know, and I think there's kind of, you know, a few that I kind of touch on briefly. I mean, there's a piece about the shift we're seeing from intangible value to tangible value in corporate valuation. So, you know, previously valuations are based on plants, machinery, equipment, and now increasingly, of course, they're based on brand, reputation, you know, stakeholder sentiment, R&D, intellectual property. So investors are taking note and they're increasingly interested in stakeholder perceptions and therefore stakeholder capitalism, which, by the way, is great for communicators because, you know, obviously it makes our jobs more strategic and more valuable, you know, because we're tasked with handling or managing many of these intangibles. And that kind of shift to intangibles has also brought with it an increased importance of license to operate, you know, which has always been important, but I think it's even more important now. You know, what do stakeholders perceive a business? Is it, you know, how do they perceive it? Is it acting fairly, appropriately or not? And then just, you know, two other things that are kind of wrapped up in that in my mind are externalities and then government. So externalities, we've always had those, but, you know, we have now, if you like, the mother of all externalities with climate change, you know, which is arguably an existential risk. So there's a real pressing need to integrate that into how businesses operate. And then as I mentioned, you know, last but not least, government. So there's been a marked reduction in public trust in governments. And I think what that's led, I mean, many root causes for that, but what that's led to is an increasing emphasis from many stakeholders for businesses to kind of step into the breach and get more involved in societal issues. So, you know, all of those things have been driving ESG over the last 10, 15 plus years. And then in addition, there are, of course, all the events that we're very aware of, you know, the big kind of epidemics and incidents we've had, COVID, BLM, social justice movements, hashtag MeToo, you know, even all the economic consequences of the global financial crisis that still reverberate. So those events, in my mind, accelerate or accentuate ESG. But the core drivers are some of those mega trends I was just talking about. So if you understand those, it helps you, you know, get better prepared for the present and future of ESG.
And yeah, I thought it was interesting when you said earlier that, you know, ESG was a more results than Kim Kardashian. But so with that, I mean, how do you think that maybe ESG has been misunderstood? You know, there's this flood of, you know, everyone's got multiple definitions, but perhaps there's not a lot of uniformity in the understanding of it. I mean, do you see that, or do the people kind of misunderstand it, or are you seeing that happen in practice?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting area because it's, I mean, some of the concepts around ESG are obviously contested. So, you know, I kind of gave a sort of high level definition at the outset about what ESG is, and it really started in the investment world. I think for many companies, it translates into sustainability. So often if you look at banks or investors, you know, if they're financing or investing in a company, they talk about certain activities as being ESG, but the company talks about the same activities as sustainability. So, you know, I think, yeah, so all these concepts can get a bit conflated, even though they're a bit separate. And then there's also the concepts of stakeholder capitalism, which I kind of just touched on, and then corporate purpose. And stakeholder capitalism for me is the idea that companies should serve, you know, an objective beyond just meeting the needs of shareholders. They should be addressing the needs of wider stakeholders. So in other words, societal interests. And that kind of contrasts with the kind of traditional, you know, shareholder capitalism view of, you know, Milton Friedman, that companies should just maximize, you know, shareholder return above all else. And therefore, in my mind, corporate purpose flows from stakeholder capitalism. And it's the concept that companies have objectives beyond profit maximization. And taken together, all these concepts, even though they're a bit confusing, if you tease them apart, they are quite distinct. And they kind of essentially represent a total paradigm shift in, you know, how we think about business.
You know, if you kind of think about the acronym, you know, I mean, each letter is probably not discrete. They're complementary of one another. So, but I mean, do you think that in the E, the environmental piece, will be the primary focus of organizations in the future? Or is there, I'm just curious about your perspective on that. You know, is there part of the acronym that will sort of stand out as being the most critical in the future?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're seeing a lot of sort of conversation, especially in the investment community, about, you know, how appropriate the acronym is. There was like a very influential article in The Economist early in the year that argued what you're kind of implying there, Peter, that we should focus on the E and get rid of the rest, which I don't necessarily agree with. But, you know, others saying that essentially we have to kind of take them all apart. They're all separate. Maybe the term itself has reached the end of its saliency, and it's better to talk about just double materiality or triple bottom line or risk management. But for me, it kind of comes back in large part to the process that companies and also communicators use to figure out what ESG means. So, you know, we talked a bit earlier about having a sort of a purpose development exercise, and then making sure that at the heart of that is the views of your stakeholders, your broader stakeholders, because otherwise it doesn't really have legitimacy. So, you know, what I have in my mind is that if you don't follow a clear purpose discovery exercise and materiality and assessment, you bring data in from all stakeholders, then there's a whole bunch of risks. I mean, one is, and this kind of talks a bit to maybe what you were alluding to, is that it does mean that ESG becomes kind of undemocratic and elitist. It shouldn't be company executives deciding what the values are that we promote in society, right, by their business operations. If that perception is left unchecked, then ESG may well just unravel altogether. And there's another risk around if you don't do that proper purpose development exercise in a company, then down the line, you may end up doing and saying the wrong things about ESG in the eyes of your customers and employees, you know, which obviously harms business reputation and business performance and also ESG implementation. So, you know, and I think research and data is key in that process. There's lots of conversation in ESG about how we need data to help companies comply with ESG reporting, which is totally right. But we also need to talk about how there's a need for data to figure out where a company stands on ESG issues in the first place. So I guess it's a long-winded way of answering your question by saying the important parts of ESG are for the relevant stakeholders to decide. And that's why you have to have the management and communications engage with those stakeholders to decipher what those things are.
Yeah, and just to go back to the TrendsWatch paper that you contributed to, I know that there was discussion over what you talked about, you know, it's kind of finding purpose. Can you just talk a little bit more about that? I mean, I know from the paper, you kind of outlined some of that, but is that, and I guess, you know, sort of a two-part question. I mean, do you see that this is a kind of what you've written about, you know, being adopted by, you know, several organizations and that, you know, the sort of that purpose exercise?
Yeah, so I mean, that's a good question. I mean, the purpose development exercise that, you know, I kind of described a little bit a few minutes ago. I mean, in a way, it's not very different to how we've always done purpose development exercises. So, you know, I talked about having what are the risks to face your business? What are the risks to face society more broadly? What are the opportunities for your business? What are the opportunities or hopes and wants of society? So just kind of looking at those four things in turn and trying to figure out what's the intersection of those things. I mean, in a way, we've always done that. But, you know, what I've been arguing is that, you know, now we have to do it by genuinely bringing in the voices of other stakeholders to the center of the process. Because normally, like in the old company purpose, that was essentially decided on by management and then signed off by boards, which was okay in the old world of shareholder capitalism, where essentially there was a consensus that companies are run for shareholders. But now if we have a new paradigm, stakeholder capitalism and ESG, if you want to stay true to that spirit, then companies are run for all their stakeholders, you know, and I would argue notably customers and employees. So all those processes that we've always had in comms to listen to those stakeholder groups and address their concerns, they really, really do become important. And I'd bring that to the very center, you know, and when you have a clear understanding of that, only then can you really start communicating.
And do you think that, you know, because there's such a lack of, I think maybe we can agree that there's, you know, kind of been this lack of trust in institutions, specifically governments, that ESG is a way for companies, organizations to kind of drive policy or change that maybe, you know, folks aren't seeing their government or local government playing the guiding hand that they would want. So almost that organizations have become more more activist in nature to kind of fill this void. And I don't know if you had perspective. I know that's a big question, but just curious.
It is a big question, but actually it's a really great question because it really does kind of lie at the heart of some of the problems and opportunities behind ESG. And in my mind, if companies are essentially going to start deciding what values to promote through their operations and in society more broadly, then just as governments must have a mandate from their citizens when they address societal issues, then companies must have a mandate from their constituents, you know, especially customers and employees. So that, you know, down the line, if somebody says, well, why did you say or do A, B, or C about ESG? You can be held accountable, you have transparency, you know, you can kind of validate what it is. And I just think it's really key to kind of really base that formulation on what the stakeholders are saying. If you've included the views of customers and employees, you know, as well as shareholders in a systematic way, and you have the data, then the business and the communicators can make a very clear case for why they've chosen a stand on certain ESG issues. And also they're less likely to fall into the pitfall of certain kinds of greenwashing, which we can also come to. But yeah, in essence though, I think it's that thing about having, you have to have a mandate from somewhere if you're a company. And obviously, I mean, I would argue if it's not your shareholders, it should be your customers, your employees, and it could be other stakeholder groups depending on your type of company. And yes, it may end up in the long term reaching a kind of rather strange place. Alison Taylor at NYU, who writes, you know, really compellingly about ESG, I mean, she talks about how we may end up in a place where, if we're not already there already, where we have, in like the US context, red companies and blue companies. You know, I mean, that may be, in my mind, it's a bit depressing because it's going to exacerbate polarization, but at least companies have put a thoughtful process behind where it is they stand on ESG issues.
Yeah, I mean, I just, because I know before we started the interview, we were talking about USC, Annenberg. So I don't know if we actually talked about the report, but the report that came out this year, The Future of Corporate Activism, and, you know, this idea that there are employees and customers that, you know, sort of expect their organizations to say something and do something. And I kind of think of like Disney in Florida and, you know, some of what happened when the bill was passed in Florida about, you know, really bringing up gender identity in the classroom. And, you know, there was interesting to see how Disney sort of came out. And I think some of that was driven by their employees and stakeholders. But it's interesting, especially specifically in the U.S., just to see these things play out more and more. And your comment about red and blue companies seems to be becoming more and more visible over the last couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because, I mean, you mentioned, you know, employees expecting companies to speak out about values. And if you look at a lot of the research around that, it's not only that employees want companies to speak out about values, they want companies to speak about, obviously, their values. That's the key part. And so that kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier, that for a company, they have to figure out what are the values of their stakeholder groups and then make sure that they honor those things. And also, by the way, it's also led to we used to have more of a hierarchical system in business, right, which was top down. One of the reasons why things are a bit more bottom up now is for that reason. I think management teams have to actually genuinely listen to the broader stakeholder groups. But if you've done that listening properly, you're in a good place. I mean, ultimately, for comms professionals, you know, if you arm yourself with that, you know, purpose development statement and your materiality assessment, those are all assets which are built on, you know, hopefully a thorough understanding of stakeholder sentiment and also balance of different stakeholder needs. Then you can pose, in my mind, there are three key questions you can pose as a screening exercise to determine what and how to communicate on ESG issues. And those questions for me are always, does the topic align with the purpose statement and materiality assessment? Secondly, can the company speak with integrity about the topic? And thirdly, is the company best placed to have an impact? And, you know, if the answer to those questions is yes, you know, then you can proceed. But then and only then can you really start communicating. I mean, that's a framework in real life. I mean, at Disney, I've kind of seen what's been happening there. I don't have any sort of particular insight on it. So it can be complex in reality. I'm sure at Disney, they did all of those things and they still had these challenges. But that's the kind of framework that I have in mind. That I think certainly clients of mine and companies where I work in-house, we've tried to use.
Well, and kind of on that topic, I mean, what are organizations or, you know, companies that you see as really moving the needle? You know, that have been successful, or, you know, as you say, have kind of gone through some of those questions and are doing, you know, living or, you know, sort of acting on their values. Are there a few companies that you have in mind?
Yeah, I mean, in my work, I straddle, you know, the kind of financial institution space and the corporate space, which is interesting from an ESG perspective, because obviously this kind of plays out a bit differently in those areas. But if you look at corporates first rather than financial institutions, you know, one corporate I'd really highlight is Neste, the Finnish oil refining and marketing company. And their business model is, you know, obviously highly connected to climate change, but they've done a really good job of transforming their business from being part of the problem, as it were, to being part of the solution. So, for example, they were a pioneer in the oil industry, making their first investment in renewable diesel, which is made entirely from renewable raw materials, back in 2005. So just a year after that UN report, you know, we talked about in 2004, and that's back when you had less than 1% of earning calls talking about ESG. So it was a really forward-thinking thing for Neste to do at the time. And if you come all the way to the present day, just a few days ago, I saw they had a strategic announcement where they've announced a review to end all refining in Finland, so end all processing of crude by the middle of the next decade. And a couple of things stand out about them. I mean, one is that they've obviously thought things through very carefully over a very long period of time in a very strategic way, and they've delivered consistently around it. So they've managed their ESG communications with financial media very effectively, but they've also raised the profile of what they're doing more broadly across mainstream media and across social media, including with a really interesting partnership that they have with the band Coldplay. So, you know, Coldplay are kind of embarking on a world tour this year, and they've partnered with Neste to help reduce the CO2 emissions. And Neste essentially will be supplying the band and their whole operations with sustainable aviation fuel, renewable fuels, which, remember, they first invested in back in 2005. So it's a very high profile partnership, and it it's kind of, it raises the profile of the activity, you know, very effectively. But unlike, you know, some partnerships and endorsements, it's not a gimmick. You know, it's very authentic. It's credible. It's rooted in this long history they have of real action that they've been taking in the space. And the other thing about them that stands out is that their comms team, which is very well regarded, as far as I can see, is organized in a very integrated way. So it's integrated across sustainability, public affairs, communications, and brand marketing. So they've emphatically integrated their sustainability activities and their comms activities. And their sort of senior executive who has the remit of both sustainability and comms, you know, she sits at board level, which obviously is key for impact. And they've been very successful with their kind of whole approach. And Peter, that's a, you know, example, as I mentioned, of sort of corporate space. I can also give you a good example from the financial institution space, if that's helpful.
Yeah, no, that'd be great.
Yeah, because again, these sort of ESG plays out differently for an operating company versus a bank or an asset manager. But in the financial institution space, I would highlight BNP Paribas, which operates actually both in banking and asset management, you know, all around the world, including actually until recently where you are, Peter, in the US with Bank of the West. But they've thought very carefully about their company purpose based on extensive consultations. So, you know, I talked a bit earlier about how it's important to have a purpose delivery exercise and a materiality assessment that's based on consultation from your stakeholders. And that's exactly what BNP Paribas have done in a very robust way over multiple years. So I think it's been three major exercises in 2015, 2016, 2018, with input from literally hundreds of employees. And this is all kind of clear and transparent on their website. And they've distilled that work into, you know, into a brand, into a business proposition, and into a whole way of being, you know, which is rooted in this kind of notion of the bank for a changing world, which is also their strapline. But they've translated that into every product, every service, every asset class that they deal with. And then crucially, you know, their words match their actions. So they're often voted, you know, within the markets by clients and counterparties as being a leading provider of sustainable finance products. So I think they've been very successful in what they've been doing.
Yeah. And, you know, the other thing that was just within the last few weeks with Patagonia, you know, where they're now basically all, you know, profits. So, you know, they'll have the money to run the business, but the profits will now go to a nonprofit, public trusts or trusts, and that will be basically just to address climate change. So it's, you know, I think annually they're predicting it's like $100 million a year. But, you know, rather than going public, they made the, I guess, the, you know, the family that owns it, you know, that was the decision they made to going forward. But it's just interesting, you know, sort of that model, because I don't think anyone's done that before.
Yeah, I think it's pretty unique. I know the model is there's a bit more, the way the financial piece is organized is kind of complex, but yep. Yeah, it sounds like it's fairly unique.
Yeah.
And also just to Patagonia, on a separate note, I mean, obviously they're a kind of, you know, category leader in the space, but it's interesting in a way because not to downplay what they've done at all because they've been hugely successful, but I think the point is if you are like a Patagonia, it's, again, I'm not downplaying, it's hard to get to that stage and they've done a lot of hard work, but kind of everyone kind of knows what your purpose is. You know, employees yes. go there for
yeah.
a reason.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, investors, but you know, invest in it. You know, customers buy their products. But for many other, like for the 99.9% or 9999 plus percent of businesses in the world, it almost feels like they've been hit by this thing, ESG.
Yeah.
And they have to figure it out. So that's why I was suggesting the purpose development exercise in the way I was and the materiality assessment. Because for most businesses, it's harder to figure out where you stand. You know, on ESG issues.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's definitely a through line. You know, it's not like I was, you know, totally surprised that Patagonia decided to go in that direction. But it struck me as really novel because I never, but certainly, not surprising given their history as an organization. So, yeah.
Absolutely. And also, I was going to say, you know, it's interesting. I mean, again, you know, for me, I'm always thinking about how ESG plays out differently across sort of companies and investors. I mean, I talked about, you know, a company, Neste, and a financial services company, BNP Paribas, but it's also interesting to look at the sort of the pure play asset managers. So if you think about the importance of mobilizing capital, obviously, to make ESG a reality. One really good case study from the asset management world that I kind of highlight is Vanguard, the asset yep. manager. And obviously, Vanguard and BlackRock are the two largest asset managers in the world. But BlackRock is very strongly associated with ESG. And yet I feel Vanguard has done a particularly good job of comms in this space as well. And, you know, we talked a bit earlier about how once you have that kind of purpose development exercise, materiality assessment, it's a bit different from asset management. Once you know where you stand on the ESG issues, you should be communicating at a sort of firm level and at a product level to be kind of consistent. And that's quite difficult the larger you get. Obviously, Vanguard is an enormous, you know, global fund shop, but they've done it really well. So at firm level, you know, they've articulated a really multifaceted approach to ESG in their own operations, which is really key to credibility. So they address, I think it's three things: climate change, diversity, inclusion, and what they call ethics, which is governance, compliance, and stewardship topics. And then at product level, I mean, like most asset managers, they describe, you know, how they integrate ESG research into their own investment process and how they evaluate and engage with companies on ESG issues and how they vote proxies in alignment with their values. But they also have what they call an ESG lineup, which kind of which is online, and you can see that they clearly break down all their ESG funds, you know, across mutual funds and ETFs according to their differing investment styles and objectives, which is really important because it makes comparison and verification of products and claims easier for all stakeholders, which, by the way, regulators are trying to do in Europe and the US. But in the case of, you know, Vanguard, you can go on the ESG lineup they have. You can see that a certain fund is, I don't know, exclusionary mutual fund. So it excludes underweight certain sectors or certain companies deriving revenue from certain activities. So you can perform that comparison and verification because of how the information is presented. And that's a really best in class approach.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah, I didn't know that about Vanguard. That's really interesting. Well, we do have one last question for you that we ask all of our guests, but what gets you up in the morning, Cam?
Yeah, sure, Peter. I can tell you, actually, it feels much, much harder these days than here in London with the increasingly darker mornings. But, you know, but seriously, on a serious note, I often feel that in my career, and I guess just in life more broadly, you know, I've kind of had one foot in financial services industry and one foot in the comms industry. And I just find it endlessly fascinating helping people sharpen their ideas, tell their stories, raise their profile at that intersection of finance, tech, capital markets, and the media. It's a lot of fun. I'd almost do it for free, but I hope none of my clients are listening to this too carefully. and, you know, when I was in-house, I was lucky enough to work with, you know, some of the best companies and brands in the market. And I got to live and work all over the world, collaborate with people from all kinds of places, which I really enjoyed doing, you know, really fascinating, interesting comms work. And since I set up my consultancy, I get to do more of that. And I also have even greater influence on the type of work I do. So that's been really energizing and refreshing.
Yeah. Well, it has been a pleasure. I have learned a ton from speaking with you, Cam. I really, really appreciate your time. And yeah, thanks so much.
Sure. Thanks so much, Peter. It's been great talking to you. It's been a fun conversation. It's an overwhelming topic, but hopefully we've
it sure is. been able to. There's a lot there.
Yeah, offer some insights.
We need a few more of these. No, thank
Absolutely.
You, Cam.
Absolutely. I'm always happy to talk. So you can always get me talking on ESG.
And thanks so much to Cam for speaking with me. I really enjoyed the interview. As I noted before, just a wealth of experience and knowledge. Certainly learned a lot. So thank you to Cam. And I believe we'll have one more episode of Pod Catalyst before the year end. So thanks a lot.